May it please the Court, my name is Jonathan Peretz. I represent John Dennison and a certified class of former employees of Mutual of New York Life Insurance Company. Mr. Dennison and the class have two
How
claims.
How many members of the class are there?
Your Honor, there are about 1,000 members of the class.
There are 1,000?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's been certified?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. And how much is the aggregate claim of the 1,000?
Mr. Dennison's claim is...
I know what his is. What is the aggregate?
We haven't had discovery into the exact amount of all of the claims, but we estimate that they are, at least under the retirement plan, in excess of $10
million. $10 million total.
Mr. Dennison and the class have two claims. One, that the company improperly cut back the value of accrued benefits in the company's qualified retirement plan by retroactively increasing the discount rate used to calculate the pension lump sum. Secondly, that the company, in calculating lump sum distributions under the non-qualified excess plan, failed to use the rate which the plan specifically provided must be used in calculating lump sums, instead using a rate which was more than double the amount used to calculate lump sums under the qualified plan. Even though the district court found that the company had made errors of both fact and law in handling Mr. Dennison's claim under the retirement plan, the court dismissed the excess plan claim on Rule 12 and granted summary judgment for the company on the claim arising under the qualified plan. And even though the company was operating under an evaluator-payer direct conflict of interest when it denied both claims, the district court deferred to the administrators.
Direct conflict of interest? What do you mean?
Under the excess plan, this was a direct contractual claim against the company. There was no trust fund involved in the excess plan. The retirement plan was trust funded, but the record shows that the company was forced to inject over $60 million to maintain the company's the trust fund solvency while these claims were pending. And under the precedents, that does create a structural conflict of interest.
How much of the $10 million is allocable to the excess plan?
We don't know exactly how much is under the excess plan. That is opaque to us. The numbers we have come from the company's filings under the retirement plan, under the qualified plan. There are no public information about what's in the excess plan. We've made some rough calculations, but obviously the amount at issue per claim is greater with the excess plan because the spread between the plan-based rate and the 7.5% rate is much larger. It's about a 30% swing between the rate which should have been applied and the 7.5% rate. Under the qualified plan, we believe that there are about $17 million paid out in lump sums for each year of the class period.
Now, what is it that you would be expecting to find in discovery? Discovery would be what, of the members of this little appellate board?
Yes, Your Honor. We would want to get into the history of how these rates have been applied during the class period, whether the company was consistent in interpreting the plan, what communications there may have been between company officials and the administrators about the financial standing of the plan, whether that influenced their thinking, what the actual decision makers knew and were concerned about when they made the decision on this particular plan, whether they viewed it as a single claim or for the potential for being a class action, which it did in fact turn out to be. All of these things we believe bear on the validity of the administrator's exercise of discretion in this case. And under the precedents, under Glenn.
So what would be the remedy? Suppose a conflict of interest were found. What next?
We believe there should have been full discovery into...
No, I understand. So on the basis of what the discovery reveals, does that mean another proceeding in the company, or does it then shift entirely to the court?
I think the court would then have jurisdiction to weigh the exercise of discretion using the conflict as one factor.
No, I understand. Suppose they decide that, on the basis of the discovery, that there was the first administrator who reviewed it, and then the board affirmed on different grounds. I suppose the court decided this was a corrupt process. So what next? Does that mean more proceedings in the company? you know, the plan administrator, or does it mean that the court would then decide the merits of the, you know, de novo, the merits of the class claims?
I believe in that case the court should exercise de novo review. In the Rayburn case, this court's precedent, the court held that where there's been an abuse of discretion under a conflict of interest, that can be used as a tiebreaker in a close case. Normally, we have the rule of contra profferentum. What changes that is the fact that this plan gives discretion to the administrator. Where the administrator has abused that discretion, as we believe they have done so here, we believe that should be reversed, and the ambiguity in the plan, if there is one, should be construed in favor of coverage. In Call, this court...
Well, that's a separate issue from the conflict of interest, though.
Well, I believe if the plan is unambiguous, we believe it's unambiguous. And
suppose it's ambiguous, so that ordinarily we give a lot of weight to this board. But suppose you get discovery and you show that the board was, you know, concerned about the financial health of the company. So my question is, what comes next? Whether there's any further board proceeding or whether the court simply decides what the entitlement is?
I believe the decision would be with the court.
Mm-hmm. Are there cases like that? Or this is unusual. I haven't seen this request for discovery before.
Well, Your Honor, in the Conkright case, the Supreme Court held that a series of misinterpretations by a plan administrator can divest the administrator of discretion. We believe that would be the appropriate remedy in this case. The administrator had multiple opportunities to construe this plan. They did so, we believe, under a conflict of interest, and they made documented errors of fact and law in construing the plan. Their initial grounds for applying the higher rates was stated both in their initial decision and in the appellate letter that they were required to do so by ERISA and by the IRS regulations. That was an error of law. They have taken the position that somehow the Benefit Appeals Committee did not adopt that error of law or corrected it. And the district court made that conclusion as well. We believe the record does not support that conclusion. If you read the communications from the Benefit Appeals Committee, it says very clearly it refers to the underlying letter. It cites that as a basis for the decision. And it goes on to say specifically that they are required to apply the higher rate. They were not required to apply the higher rate. In fact, they were required not to apply the higher rate if it reduced the value of those lump sums under the anti-cutback provision in the plan. And this court in Call made it very clear that a plan's anti-cutback provision can be, and in that case was found to be, broader than ERISA. And it's also worth noting here that one of their arguments is that the Section 1107 of the PPA of 2006 gave them this safe harbor, that without the safe harbor, there would have been a violation of the anti-cutback provision based on the going to the segment rates. They attempt to rely on that safe harbor. That in itself is an admission that prior to the amendment, ERISA would have barred them from raising the discount rates and thereby lowering the values of those lump sums. And they've maintained that throughout their own anti-cutback provision is supposed to be as broad as the ERISA anti-cutback provision. To me, that is an admission that without that safe harbor, they would be in violation. The safe harbor under Call is not enough to override the contractual anti-cutback. They had an anti-cutback that was broader than ERISA, and Congress did not attempt to override private contractual anti-cutback provisions.
This whole argument is based on the assumption that the accrued benefit that can't be cut back under the anti-cutback provision in the plan includes the method that the plan prescribes for reducing the straight life annuity to present value.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if you lose on that argument, all of the rest of this argument doesn't matter, right?
Well, I would agree with that if the court finds that the plan unambiguously does that. That
looks pretty unambiguous, right? I mean, it allows the... First, it says that the rights of the early retiree shall be determined solely under the terms of the plan as in effect on the date of his or her termination. And then it says, unless otherwise, unless the new, the changed plan is made applicable to former employees. Isn't that pretty clear?
Well, that is, you're quoting from the preamble there, the provision that discusses amendments specifically and retroactivity of amendments is section 13.11. That doesn't simply protect the straight life annuity, that protects the defined term accrued benefit. And when you look at the definition of accrued benefit, you find in section 1.2 that it is defined as the value of a participant's retirement benefit, and that's also a defined term, expressed as a straight life annuity determined according to the terms of the plan. We believe that clearly means that the anti-cutback protection is not limited to the straight life annuity. It applies to the value of a participant's defined retirement benefit, which explicitly includes the lump sum. And it goes beyond that. It even gives you the formula for defining the lump sum. It gives you the PBGC rate. That was the rate in effect when Mr. Dennison terminated employment. And this is important, and it makes sense, because the whole point of ERISA is to protect retirees' legitimate investment and retirement expectations. When Mr. Dennison was a participant in this plan, he knew what his straight life annuity would be, and he knew that if he elected a lump sum, it would be determined according to the PBGC rate.
Right, but the specific language in the definition of accrued benefit excludes inclusion of the lump sum method determination requirements in the plan or specifications in the plan by virtue of the words expressed as a straight life annuity. That's a limiting phrase on the term value of the participant's retirement benefit.
Your Honor, I believe the reason for that is that the entire structure of ERISA and of this plan is to take a benchmark form of retirement benefit. In this case, it's the straight life annuity. And to equate other forms of benefit, other optional forms of benefit, to that straight life annuity. And to do that, you need to have actuarial equivalence. And the plan says this. The plan says that all optional forms of benefit must be the actuarial equivalent to the straight life annuity, and then goes on to tell you exactly how to find that actuarial equivalent.
Right, but the point is the optional elections aren't locked in against change because the accrued benefit definition is limited to the value of the benefit expressed as a straight life annuity.
Yes, but
not the optional lump sum.
I disagree, Your Honor. I believe that language brings in all forms of retirement benefit and simply makes the point that the value is protected, the value of all forms of retirement benefit are protected from cutback.
What is the meaning of the inclusion of the phrase expressed as a straight life annuity then?
Because you need a lodestar, you need a benchmark to calculate the lump sum. And that benchmark
But the natural reading of it is just Judge Sykes is I think, suggesting, is that that accrued benefit means the annuity, and then there are these various substitutes, you know, sort of alternatives like the lump sum. And of course, you can understand why you have a problem here. So suppose that the plan is old and the actuarial value was determined on the basis, say, of very, very low interest rates. So, and now, many, many years later, this person takes early retirement, and he's done it because interest rates have soared. So he figures if he gets a lump sum discounted very modestly because it used the annuity rate, he's going to get a huge lump sum. He's going to invest it and have very high interest rates. So that's a problem. And you could say, well, but the interest rate change could go the other way. And so, you could see how the plan might be concerned that it doesn't want to be in a position where a change in interest rates increases its liability.
Your Honor,
realistically, the lump sum isn't the equivalent of the annuity. That depends on the difference in the interest rate, current interest rates, and the interest rates in the annuity.
Your Honor, it's essential to understand here that the PBGC rate, that is, we believe the correct rate, is not a fixed rate. It is a variable rate. It is the PBGC rate, in other words, the rate used by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation to value annuities, as in effect within 120 days following that person's eligibility for retirement. So it's a floating variable rate. It takes into account changing economic conditions. That it's akin to a variable mortgage. When you take out a mortgage, you have a variable interest rate tied to a specific index, such as LIBOR or such as some other index.
You're saying you're entitled to annuity, that. The annuity discount rate is determined when he retires?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a variable rate. The PBGC rate is not a.
How is it calculated?
The rate that was published as would apply to Mr. Dennison's claim specifically was 3%. So there's a spread there of 3%.
But I mean, how is it calculated?
I don't know exactly the formula for calculating it. It's published, and it's. I honestly don't know the exact formula for calculating
it. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Perl. I'll give you more time later.
Can I turn to the excess plans?
But your time has expired. I'll give you more time later.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hacker?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. John Hacker for the Mone Plans. I'll start where Your Honor started with the question of discovery because I think it's easily disposed of. It's really sort of a red herring here. There's no reason even to think about or entertain discovery, as the other side suggests. Judge Crabb had exercised reasonably her wide discretion to deny discovery beyond the administrative record, and that's the key here. In the ERISA cases, review is on the administrative record. And it's only in the rarest exceptional cases where you go outside the administrative record, and this isn't one of them. First of all, with respect to the RISB plan, which we'll talk about in a moment, it's perfectly clear, so it doesn't matter. There could be the worst kind of conflict in the world, and I assure you there is not, but there's only one correct interpretation, and it's the one that the administrator adopted, largely for the reasons that Judge Sykes elaborated. Further, the only conflict they really point to is the trust funding position in 2008 during the economy-wide, worldwide recession, but by their own class allegations, which Your Honor started by pointing out, Judge Posner, their own class allegations established that the plan has been pursuing it this way forever, for as long as the class has been around. So it wasn't like they changed positions because of the recession to deal with a problem, a sudden problem. This is how it's been going on for as long as anybody knows the plan has been administered. So there's, on its face, that conflict doesn't begin to suggest any kind of corruption or bias, which is what they would need to show. Similarly, with respect to the excess plan, they only point to the so-called structural conflict, which we know from consistent case law itself is not enough to establish either the existence of bias or even a justification for further discovery. There's nothing with respect to the excess plan. And again, for as long as we know, this is exactly how the plan has been construed. Mr. Dennison's own estimate in 1996, and you'll find this at SA 40 and 57, SA 40 and SA 57, when he requested an estimate of his benefits in 1996 under the excess plan, the lump sum estimate was calculated to be to use the 7.5% other purposes rate, exactly as happened later in 2009 and 2010. So again, it's a consistent interpretation.
Are there other people who have, in approximately his position, who have over the years taken this this early retirement, asked for a lump sum and the determination of how much they
did? The administrative record discloses the administrator statement that this is the rate that's always been used, the other purposes rate, which is consistent with his own experience in 1996. So that's the only information that we have from the administrative record. And again, it shows consistency, which on its face is literally the opposite of arbitrariness. If they were doing it every year differently in a way that most benefits the company in a given year, that would be a different kind of case, not what we have here. So let's turn to the RISB plan, if I may. And we need to begin by analyzing that by reference to the standard that this court is engaged in. It is the decision by the administrators given the widest possible deference, the arbitrary and capricious or abuse of discretion review has been described as, quote, the least demanding form of appellate review. The question isn't whether it's right, but whether it's plausible. And that standard for both plans, both calculations, is easily satisfied here. With respect to the RISB, the interpretation, or rather the amendment to the lump sum calculation is both authorized by the plain terms of the statute and authorized by the plain and unambiguous terms of the plan. I think the statutory argument is set forth in our brief. There's not case law support, but it's a bit of a novel argument. We think it's correct for the reasons we say in the brief, but I don't think you need to reach that because the plan is perfectly clear. And everybody agrees, and I think you just heard it, Mr. Parrott said, is so long as we're right under the plan, the argument just drops out of the case. And here the plan clearly authorized this amendment in the application of the segment rate to the calculation of Mr. Dennison's lump sum under 13.11B. That plan provision authorizes amendment. It's not just an anti-cutback rule, as it's described by the other side. It's actually affirmative authorization for amendments, including retroactive amendments. It authorizes amendments, except three different types. One is an amendment that would misuse plan assets. A second one is one that would reduce accrued benefits, which is a defined term. And a third one is that it prohibits is an amendment that would eliminate the optional form of a benefit. We're not talking about A and B. We're talking about the reduction of accrued benefits. And as Judge Sykes pointed out, the plan defines accrued benefit as the value of a participant's retirement benefit expressed as a straight life annuity. Now, Mr. Parrott's argument is, well, when you look at the definition of retirement benefit, it includes various optional sums. But the 13.11B doesn't prohibit reductions in the retirement benefit. It prohibits reductions in the accrued benefit. And what the definition of accrued benefit is telling you is you look at retirement benefit, and then you identify one particular form of that retirement benefit, and that's what can't be reduced. You take the retirement benefit, you express it in the form of a straight life annuity, and then you look to see if the plan amendment reduces that straight life annuity. That's the only question with respect to reductions of accrued benefits, and it is conceded here that the straight life annuity isn't changed. His straight life annuity is $1,888.46 a month. That's what it was in 1996. That's what it is today. It did not and never will change. There's been no reduction in the accrued benefit as defined by the plan.
Is it possible for a lump sum measure to accrue?
I don't know that it's impossible. I suppose a plan could be written to say once you have a form of lump sum, it will never change. I wouldn't.
In this type of retirement plan,
I've never seen that before.
The normal meaning of accrued is simply that it's been determined and it's entitlement.
It's settled.
But you're saying that accrued benefit has a different meaning here. I mean, it's a defined term.
It's right. It's defined as the benefit.
So it's a more limited. I mean, you could certainly say his. His lump sum was an accrued benefit. It accrued to him. It was his.
Well, he was entitled to a lump sum, and that's what actually subsection C addresses. They couldn't eliminate the lump sum. So in that sense, in a colloquial way, it's an accrued right under the plan.
What about the excess plan? That's not as clear cut, is it? I mean, what is the plan authority for using this 7.5% rate?
Well, under the excess plan, unlike the RISB plan, there's no specified rate at all with respect to the excess plan. It simply says excess benefits must be paid at the same time and, quote, in the same form as the RISB. Now, to be clear, what Mr. Parrott in his brief suggests is that's saying it has to be calculated in the same way. So he just literally rewrites the provision. It actually says it has to be paid in the same form. It doesn't say or even suggest that it has to be calculated in the same way. It is paid in the, quote, same form.
But your argument, isn't it, that the excess plan is something for other purposes?
Exactly. To get to it, under the excess plan itself doesn't tell you how to calculate the lump sum. It's just literally silent. There's nothing there. And so you turn, except it says paid for in the same form as RISB, so it makes some sense to turn to the RISB plan, which is what the administrator has done for as long as anybody knows, has turned to the RISB plan and looked the multiple possible rates there. There is a rate that is prescribed for under RISB Section 1.3, quote, for purposes of determining lump sum distributions and for all other payment forms subject to Code Section 417E. So that's one type of rate. And there's another rate that says for all, quote, all other purposes, you use the 7.5% rate. And the administrator from time immemorial has construed it to use, has construed the excess plan to be the lump sums are to be calculated using the 7.5% rate. That's perfectly reasonable. It makes perfect sense because the two plans are accomplishing very different things. The RISB plan is an ERISA-governed, tax-qualified plan that provides benefits for rank-and-file employees subject to all of the protections that ERISA and the tax code provides. The excess plan is an entirely different animal. It's like a gravy benefit, provides extra benefits for the highest-paid employees in the company. And with respect to that kind of plan, it's not governed by the tax code. It's not governed by ERISA. The company can provide whatever, define whatever benefits it wants to pay its highest paid executives.
That, you know, it's not in the form of a trust or anything, so that money comes directly out of the corporate till. And that's the one basis of his argument for discovery, that there can be no filtering by a trustee who has trustee duties to protect the persons who are entitled to this.
That's right, but there's no case from this court or any other that I'm aware of, and indeed this court is in an important opinion by Judge Flom, has specifically held that it's not enough simply to say that there is a structural conflict. As you yourself said in the Mars case, that's a given in virtually all ERISA cases, that there's some form of conflict. Somebody has to pay the benefits and somebody has to pay the decision maker. So there's always a conflict. And the rule can't be that just because there's that conflict, we get to open up the doors of discovery and go for the fishing expedition to see if somebody was corrupted, when on the face of the process, and that's what we have here, when on the face of the process, everything looks to be perfectly regular. The question really is there under the case of Semyon, which is the governing precedent in this circuit, the question is whether there's something on the face of the record that suggests that there has been a failure to conduct a genuine evaluation. That's what you're looking for. If you've got that kind of problem, where you say something's really wrong here, it looks like the administrator was corrupted, then that's a justification for going further. And there's nothing at all here. The process worked here exactly like it's supposed to. Look at what Mr. Peretz points to with respect to the administrator's decision. The administrator, the first-line decision-maker, is said to have made an error of fact because it applied the rate, the segment rate, when that hadn't actually been adopted yet. But that's perfectly consistent with the PPA. It's explicitly authorized by Congress. It says the plans can do that. So that's not a mistake. That's just following the law and following its rights under the law. So there's no irregularity or evidence of corruption there. In respect to the asserted mistake of law, it is said that the administrator incorrectly said that the 417E, or the segment rate, is required by 417E. First of all, it's not entirely clear that's what the administrator was saying, as opposed to the administrator was saying that she had to apply was required to apply the 417E rate because that's what the plan provided. The administrator has to follow the plan. But even if you accept that it was a mistake of law because the plan didn't have to be amended to adopt the 417E rate, that's not a mistake that was repeated by the Benefits Appeals Committee. There's just no evidence at all, and Judge Crabb correctly held that it wasn't. This argument was made to the Benefits Appeals Committee. Mr. Peretz and other lawyers on Mr. Dennison's behalf submitted their letters and said, this is a problem, and you should reverse it for that reason. And the Benefits Appeals Committee, by all evidence, was apparently persuaded because it didn't repeat that mistake. It gave three other reasons why this was an appropriate decision, most importantly because the accrued benefit wasn't reduced. So there's no problem there. And Judge Crabb correctly said that the Benefits Appeals Committee, there's no basis for inferring that the Benefits Appeals Committee, out of corruption and a desperate effort to protect the finances of the company, continued to do what it had always done.
Is it standard practice in benefits practice to define accrued benefit for purposes of an anti-cutback provision, either private or the public one contained in ERISA, by reference to straight life annuity and then exclude, at least implicitly, alternative measures of the benefit like the lump sum?
It really is, Your Honor. I mean, that's how ERISA defines accrued benefit. Is the normal retirement benefit, which is defined as an annual benefit. So a slightly different way of saying the same thing, which is it's the annuity. ERISA doesn't refer to an accrued benefit or a cutback as addressing the lump sum. There is a case on this point that's similar, but I think ultimately helps us, which is the Call case, and a decision by Judge Posner addressed this kind of, again, somewhat analogous situation, and said in that case, the lump sum interest rate calculation was effectively an accrued benefit that couldn't be reduced. But the difference is so blatantly obvious because the gravamen of the holding was the plan in that case didn't define accrued benefit to be limited to straight life annuity, didn't define it in a capital A, capital B way that you have here. And that's the dispositive distinction, and that demonstrates exactly why this plan and the administrator complied with the terms of the plan.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Hacker. And Mr. Peretz, you can have a minute or two if you have anything exciting.
Yes, Ron, I really would like to focus on the language under the excess plan because I believe it really doesn't permit any ambiguity whatsoever. The excess plan provides that benefits.
Is this in your appendix?
Yes, Section 5A of the excess plan. It's our supplemental appendix at 66.
What page?
66 of our supplemental appendix.
Did you say 56 or 66?
66.
What?
66.
Okay.
So Section 5A says that excess retirement plan benefits shall commence on the same date and shall be in the same form as the benefits under the retirement plan. The excess plan doesn't say anything else about benefits or forms. It points you simply to the retirement plan. And then the retirement plan, when you look at calculating actuarial equivalence, which is how you determine the value of the lump sum under Section 9, and this is Supplemental Appendix 80 to 81.
I don't know what you get from same form, because the sentence shall commence on the same date and shall be in the same form as the benefits under the retirement plan unless a different payout option is elected.
Yes.
That sounds as if the choice between, you know, the lump sum and...
Right. In other words, your benefits under the excess plan are, you have the same types
of
benefits. Yes.
It's the form.
Yes, Your Honor. And
it's not the interest rate.
If you want the form of a lump sum, then look at the form of lump sum as defined in the retirement plan. And the retirement plan defines exactly what a lump sum is. It
but
says
the other purposes clause.
Let me address that, Your Honor. At the definition of actuarial equivalence, that is where this rubber hits the road. Actuarial equivalence is defined, quote, for purposes of determining the lump sum of a retirement benefit. The PBGC rate is used. That PBGC rate then became the Treasury rate, then became the segment
rate. Where are you looking? Where are you
at
looking?
Supplemental Appendix 80 to 81.
If you could use the plan number.
This is Section 1.36 of the RISPI plan, the retirement plan.
Yeah, on page 81. Okay.
And you see under the definition of actuarial equivalent, means a benefit of equivalent value to another form of benefit. And it goes on to say, for purposes of determining the lump sum of a retirement benefit, the PBGC rate is used.
This is on page 80, right?
Yes.
Not 81.
And it goes on to say on 81, for other purposes, the following assumptions shall be used, 7.5%. Clearly, other purposes means a purposes other than determining the lump sum of a retirement benefit. All RISPI says about determining the value of lump sums is right here in the definition of actuarial equivalence. It starts as the PBGC rate, it becomes the Treasury rate, and then it becomes the segment rate. Whichever of those three rates applies, and if we lose on that issue, and the court finds that they were able to raise the benchmark rate for lump sums, that is the rate that must be applied to the excess plan. It is clearly improper to apply a rate designated for use for other purposes in the same sentence as the definition that provides for the purpose of determining the lump sum of a retirement benefit.
Where in this section 136 is it? Oh, you're saying this is
this
plan, you're saying.
Yes. Section 9 discusses lump sums. And Section 9 says that all forms of optional benefit must be the actuarial equivalent to the straight life annuity. You then look for the definition of actuarial equivalence, and that's in Section 1.36. And that's what I'm reading from. It says, for purposes of determining the lump sum of a retirement benefit, use the PBGC rate.
Wait, I'm
not
lost.
The other purpose.
Is this thing? this plan that begins on SA60. I see. So everything between SA60 and SA80. This is just the excess plan. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So you're saying that this provision
1.36, that comes out of the retirement plan, because the excess plan simply says for the forms, look to the retirement plan. So when you look at SA 80 to 81, you're looking at the retirement plan in effect when Mr. Dennison terminated employment. And that's where you see the other purposes rate. Other purposes means purposes other than calculating lump sums. So it has to be the rate that applies to calculating the lump sum under the excess plan. There is no other provision that could control what the administrator does with calculating a lump sum. It tells you exactly how to do it. It's the lump sum rate that applies under the retirement plan.
I'm sorry. I'm very confused. As I understand, the excess plan is actually just this first 8 pages, right? And after that is the full plan. Isn't that right? I'm missing something.
Okay, the excess plan is SA 60.
Right. And 60 through 69, right?
Yes, and it's
so what comes after that, the long That's the overall plan.
That's the retirement plan.
That's the overall plan.
Yes, that's the overall plan.
I mean, that's the retirement plan, not the excess plan.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why is it so clear to you, looking at the looking at 136, why are you so clear that that is a reference to the excess plan?
There is no reference in the retirement plan explicitly to the excess plan.
Right.
The only thing that ties those two plans together is the provision in the excess plan, which says that benefits shall be paid in the same form as under the retirement plan. Then you go to the retirement plan and you see exactly how lump sums are calculated.
No, but sorry to be so dense about it, but the provision you read us, 1.36, this is in the retirement plan. This is not in the excess plan.
Yes.
So how do we know that the reference here is to the excess plan when it talks about the... I mean, why can't the other purposes on page 81, why can't the other purposes, which you get the 7.5% interest as the discount rate, why can't that be the excess plan?
Because, Your Honor, these two plans have to be construed together. They're clearly two documents that are meant to work together. They must be construed together. And of the two documents, the one that is most specific about this issue that we're discussing here, which is what formula applies to calculate the lump sum under the excess plan, the provision that is most specific there is the excess plan. And it says, look to how we do it under the retirement plan. It's that simple. We don't have any formulas here. We don't have any forms of benefit under the excess plan. All of that is packaged under the retirement plan. And if you want to know how it works, go look at the retirement plan. And that tells us it's the
PBGC. Let me ask you another question about the discovery. So Mr. Hacker said that the administrator testified that, or stated, that they've always done it this way. They've never changed it, even when, you know, they had the financial pressures of 2008. So is that not true? Or?
Your Honor, I wish I could tell you if it was true. This is simply an unsworn statement in a letter. There was no deposition of the person who wrote that letter, Ms. Grevelding. There was zero discovery, zero. We, as soon as the judge denied their motion to dismiss our claim under the retirement plan, the first thing we did was talk about discovery.
But surely you could find some former employee to and ask the person whether, you know, It's always been done this way, right?
Well, I believe one of the earlier cases this week talked about solicitation of customers, so we were very careful not to do that. Our client, Mr. Dennison, we learned from his experience.
I'm worried about the discovery because, I mean, suppose you had a proceeding before the SEC. Everyone knows the SEC is a revolving door agency. And the object, you go to work for the SEC so that after a few years you can go and become a partner in a New York law firm. So what if people said, look, when they decided this case against me, they were thinking of their future employment on Wall Street, and I'd like to really dig in and see what the motivations of these people are. We wouldn't allow that, right? We just don't allow that.
I think this
this benefits review committee. This is a private administrative agency, right?
It's a group of private people. We don't know what measures they took to preserve the independence.
No, but
of
this is
group.
True for in every ERISA case.
And the Supreme Court has directed us to consider the gravity.
No, I can't. I've never had a case where we authorized discovery.
Your Honor, after Glenn in 2008, there have been a lot of district court cases that have said we must allow some targeted discovery. We're not looking to open the floodgates here. This is a very specific case, and this is not even simply a one-person disability determination case. This is a fairly unique case involving construction of a plan.
Discovery in a class action is a horror, right? Once that door is open, they're going to settle with you, right?
Well, I think Judge Crabb...
That's the game in class actions. They almost never go to trial. The idea is to put as much cost and threat on the defendant to force a settlement.
Your Honor, that certainly is not our intention in this case.
I'm not accusing you of that, but...
We simply want to understand, we believe we have a right to understand what measures were taken to minimize this conflict, to achieve independence. Basic issues such as how is the plan interpreted internally in other cases. With each increase in the discount rate, was there other consideration of applying the anti-cutback provision in a different way? You asked Mr. Hacker whether it is normally the case that an anti-cutback provision includes lump sums. In fact, that is the normal rule. That is why in the PPA of 2006 they had to open up this very limited window of exemption in order to permit lump sums to be calculated using a higher rate. Without that, there would have been a violation of the ERISA anti-cutback provision. And that is why this anti-cutback provision should be interpreted to include lump sums. That is normally how ERISA's anti-cutback provision works. All forms of benefit are protected from cutback. It doesn't make sense to protect the straight life annuity and let them monkey with the definitions of actuarial equivalence in order to reduce the value of the lump sum.
It can confer a windfall depending on how the PGBC interest rate corresponds to the actual market interest rate.
It can also provide a windfall to the company.
That's right.
That's looking to avoid another injection of cash.
Who is to bear the risk of interest rate changes?
Well, in this case, it was specifically negotiated, if you will. It was part of the. It wasn't negotiated per se, but it was part of the deal. Mr. Dennison's retirement deal said PBGC rate, as though his mortgage specified it'll be LIBOR will determine your variable rate. He had a right to rely on that.
Well, you agree it can be changed.
And just as the index, just as LIBOR changes. But he was told, this is your index, the PBGC rate. That is your index.
Retroactive adjustment of interest rates is permitted. I mean, you're arguing about the clarity of the...
Your Honor, I believe that it is improper for a company to cut back, this is under ERISA, to cut back the value of lump sums by raising the discount rate. If they have the unlimited ability to do that, in essence, they have the ability to eliminate the lump sum form.
But they can change the rate. May not be unlimited authority, but they can change rates.
They can only change the rate up to limits set by Congress. But if the plan, and this is what you said in the call case, if the plan allows broader protection, the plan protection
controls. But it's a matter of the plan can be... Okay, well, we had... enough.
If I could just clarify one thing with respect to your argument about the excess plan.
Yes,
the excess plan is not tax qualified.
That's correct.
The PBGC rate applies only to tax qualified plans.
We believe the PBGC rate applies to this plan because the excess plan says look to the retirement plan.
Well, it says look to the entirety of the retirement plan and
yes.
how it calculates the benefit, and it sets forth these different methods and says for all other purposes, which at least arguably this is how the administrator interpreted it, the other purposes provision applies to non-tax qualified plans.
But I don't believe there's any textual
that rate, that PBGC rate.
I just don't believe that that interpretation is consistent with the plain language of the plan. It says for purposes of calculating the lump sum of a retirement benefit, use the PBGC rate. For other purposes, it can only mean for purposes other than calculating the lump sum of a retirement benefit. That's
but
what you did in the excess
clear,
plan.
Just to be clear, you do recognize the authority of the plan to change the interest rate.
We believe they cannot do that retroactively.
As a matter of contract or as a matter of law? As a matter of contract. As a matter of But if it were clear in the contract, then...
Then they're subject to ERISA's limits.
Pardon?
Then they're subject to statutory limits.
But the statute permits them.
The statute permitted it in a limited case in this particular case. Our position is that the contractual anti-cutback did not permit it, and that is why...
But you are relying on the contract, not on the statute. Okay, well, thank you very much, and thank you to both counsel, but also thank you for very good arguments, both of you.